Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Castle Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning there, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So, I got to tell you, I want to start out this show talking about fish a little bit.
All right.
There's been a lot of press about, actually not a lot, but certainly on the West Coast, there's been a lot of press about the cost of wild salmon.
Something fishy there, huh?
Oh, golly. Wild salmon has sold for as much as $37 a pound for Copper River salmon in supermarkets.
Let's backtrack and explain a little something to our guests. There's a big controversy now. There's a big choice to be made between wild salmon, which tastes better and is better for you usually, and that's my own personal opinion, so no one should sue me for it. between wild salmon and farmed salmon. Now, among wild salmon, there are different kinds of wild salmon, and the different rivers, especially at the mouth of the rivers in the Pacific Northwest and in Alaska. Copper River is a specific river in Alaska, where the fish are known because it's such a hard river to get up. The particular type of fish, and remember, when we talk about specific rivers, because salmon always return to the same river, they return to where they were hatched to spawn. So different rivers will have different types of salmon.
Characteristics in the salmon. Not just different breeds, which there are obviously different breeds of salmon as well, but the salmon themselves will have different characteristics.
And, you know, the Copper River is a very tough river to get up, and so the salmon build up a huge store of fat at the beginning of the year when they begin the runs. And that fat, it translates to flavor. I mean, it translates to beautiful, beautiful flavor. But you were talking about prices.
Well, so last year we had this big controversy over counterfeit salmon in the marketplace. New York Times did a front page story on it. And there was a lot of talk about people selling wild salmon, farm-raised salmon, as wild salmon.
Right, counterfeit.
Which was a real issue. This year the problem is wild salmon has gotten more and more press and more people talking about the health benefits of wild salmon. What we're seeing is a huge increase in price, 50, 75, 100% in some places. Copper River salmon in a supermarket, and that's what I started to say before, $37 on restaurant menus.
A pound. $37
a pound.
A pound.
On restaurant menus, $55 a portion on the West Coast. And I think that's a two-part issue. And the first is simply supply and demand. It's very early in the season, so you're not seeing a ton of salmon in the marketplace. So people are just spending whatever they need to spend to get wild salmon. We spent a fortune last weekend on an ivory wild salmon, a king salmon, from Alaska as well. But at the same time, they're spending a lot of money because there's just such a huge demand for this fish.
You know, but
I'm not ready to pay $37 a pound.
I'm not ready to pay 37 bucks a pound.
It's spectacular, though. It's something, honestly, if it were $37 a pound and that were the price of it forever, it's something it would become a once-in-a-while thing for me.
Once a year.
Right. Where now, wild salmon, I must eat it in the 6, 8, 10-week season where it's really abundant, you know, this late spring, early summertime, I eat it. You know, four times a week, because I love it so much. It's got a much richer flavor profile than the farm-raised salmon that we've all kind of become accustomed to.
But again, there's a difference between just general wild salmon and Copper River wild salmon.
Absolutely.
And, you know, different.
And there's also different breeds of salmon, and that's something that people need to realize as well. The salmon that we tend to use in our restaurant whenever possible is king salmon. King salmon is a salmon that is obviously, just from the name of it, you can tell is kind of the biggest of all the salmon, and tends to be very rich and has a lot of fat content. When a product is scarce, when it's rare, and a lot of people think it's really special and really want it, price will go up.
Crazy stuff. You know, reminds me of, there is a chocolate that is marking my favorite chocolate in the world as far as raw chocolate. There are several chocolatiers or chocolatiers.
Thank you. Chocolatiers. I'm sure they'd love to be called
that. It's like a mousketeer, but you make chocolate. You wear the hat. You don't wear the hat. It's different. But the ears would melt. But if you go to like the Godiva store, Godiva does something better than almost any other chocolatier. It's the boxes, the golden boxes.
Very attractively packaged.
Beautiful box.
They've done a great job packaging.
Blech chocolate.
Honestly, for me, I don't think it's blech chocolate. I just think that there are chocolates that I like better that are 12% of the price, 15% of the price.
I'd rather have a Hershey bar.
I would not rather have a Hershey bar,
Special
for instance.
Dark?
I'd rather have Godiva chocolate than a Hershey bar. But the next step up from Hershey bar, I'd rather have.
In the world of chocolate, I mean, there's packaging and there's also real chocolate taste. And it's not just about cocoa content.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, here's how chocolate's made. I mean, there are four ingredients to chocolate. It's cocoa butter, vanilla, and sugar. That's it. That's all you get in real chocolate.
Right.
And there's
no corn syrup in there?
And how that's done? Well, even among high-end chocolatiers, what they usually do among high-end chocolatiers, I just can't say that all the time.
You're just going to keep saying chocolatiers?
I know. It just sounds fancy schmancy.
then you're going to keep getting that look from me from across the studio that you've been getting every time you say it.
But what most high-end chocolate makers do, like Valrhona is a great high-end chocolate maker. They actually make chocolate. But anything smaller than that, those people buy chocolate and make candies.
Mm-hmm.
There is a small company in Italy, and Valrhona is a chocolate maker, a chocolatier, and you can buy Valrhona chocolate. We use Valrhona chocolate in our restaurant.
There are a couple places like Whole Foods. There's a lot of stores that now carry Valrhona.
But Amadei, it's Amadei, is an Italian chocolatier, and they make chocolate. They don't just make candy. They make some of the highest-end chocolate in the world, and it's just become available in the country again for like $100 for a pound of chocolate, which is just crazy. We actually, when it was in the country last, we got some, and just before they lost their last distribution, we picked up a bunch of it for $20 a pound. We picked up like 75 pounds of it for $100.
And awesome. I mean,
at $20 a pound.
An absolutely awesome
chocolate.
It was
tremendous. But at $100 a pound, that becomes, again, a once in a while.
You know, I think $100 a pound, and you're almost never going to get to hear me say this on the radio show for something that I adore. I think it's too expensive.
Well, it depends. You got to make more from the radio show.
Perhaps I'm not wealthy enough.
I think
really
that you're out of the Amadei League. But the thing about Amadei chocolate is they actually make chocolate. They buy raw cacao and make chocolate there, and they have an expiration date on their chocolate. And it really is, I tell you, if you see it out there, because it's going to become available, it's in a few shops in the United States. You can go to a Chocosphere. I believe you can find it online. We'll put up a link to our website.
The world has changed, huh?
I
was talking to somebody that Amadei chocolate's no longer available in the United States, and they sent me a little email like 12 minutes later. Sure it is. Look, right here. I Googled it.
And you can have it shipped.
There it is.
Worth trying. It is probably the best chocolate in the world, but unless you're rich, I don't know, might just give yourself a habit you can't live with. Hey, listen, we're going to be talking with Farmer John. He's the subject of a new documentary that you can find on PBS coming up next week, or you can find through our website. Really tremendous. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 14:50. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is someone I've been waiting to get on the show for quite a while. His name is John Peterson. He's a lifelong farmer, and he also runs the largest community-supported farm in the country, Angelic Organics. More than 1,000 families get their vegetables delivered from John's farm weekly. He's also an artist and a writer. The Real Dirt on Farmer John is a documentary spanning decades of his farm's struggle, near bankruptcy, rebirth, and return to solvency. It's also about him. It's also about America.
John, how are you today? Welcome to the show.
Good, thank you.
Or should we call you Farmer John?
A lot of people call me Farmer John.
So, John, the film is about your farm, and your family's been farming since the 30s. And you went through the debt crisis of the 80s, and you had to sell a lot of your land, and you've been able to reinvent the farm and make it solvent again. This film spans your whole life. Is the film about you? Is the film about farms? Or is the film about America?
Well, it's I it's basically my life story, and that includes the farm, because the farm and I have been woven together since I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people now, it's going to air on PBS on June 13th, and they were talking to me about creating a site on the webpage that correlates my personal history with that of the macrocosmic history of American agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't seen that yet, but, you know, there's a lot of correlations, but then I'm such a, you know, I'm not a real typical farmer, and so there's going to be some deviations, too. For instance, I immersed myself in the hippie era, and a lot of farmers, other farmers, did not.
Yeah, that's not our image of farmers.
But still, but I would say from the time that you put the farm into a lot of debt based on I don't want to say promises from banks, but certainly false expectations, from that moment forward, I think that your plight was very close to exactly what a lot of the small farmers in the United States faced, and that was what I really related to in the movie.
I went through a very funny, weird program about the film recently, where experts were doing the commentary on my life, and it was a really interesting thing that they said. I went in disguise because I was told that the experts were the ones who were going to tell my story and that they could do a good job of it. And I said, well, no, I think I could do a better job of it since I was living my life. And anyway, it was interesting to hear these experts' analysis of the situation. And I had to finally, you know, stand up and reveal myself to the whole audience.
You don't strike me as the kind of guy who would not reveal yourself to the whole audience.
I'm Farmer John in disguise. But the interesting thing was they said millions of farmers worked hard. They were no nonsense. They were great farmers, and they lost their land in the early 80s. And it just happened that Farmer John Peterson lost his farm at the same time, but he lost it for very different reasons. He partied.
Oh, man.
And you know, it's interesting. When I finally revealed myself, and I was wearing this goatee and this wig, and I had all this makeup on, I spent the whole afternoon at a costume shop in on Broadway and 11th in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
So I just thought, well, this is going to be really interesting to hear what people have to say about my life. But the thing is, I felt agriculture should be celebrated.
Mm-hmm.
Some hard party. I felt that it had become very barren, very void of actual life, of a kind of a heart relationship. And so in the 70s, I felt that besides running a farm, we needed to acknowledge that we were on a farm and that we were growing food and that we were in a place of life.
You talk in the film, it follows you on a sojourn or a number of sojourns to Mexico, and it draws some stark comparisons between American agriculture and Mexican agriculture that sort of speak to that. You want to talk to us about that?
Well, in the 50s, before the farm chemicals came in and started to dominate agriculture, I feel that American farmers really were truly closer. They were close to the land. They lived out of a relationship to the land. It's a much more authentic relationship. And then when chemicals came in, they just got in the way of that. They got in the way of that profound, intimate connection to the land. There's still a connection, but it's different. And so I think the whole character of rural rural society began to change out of people farming with chemicals, and that changing their relationship to the land.
How so? How did it change the fabric of the society when people started farming with chemicals?
Well, it made it so farmers could farm more land, and the consequence of that was that they were less associated, less connected to each unit of land that they were farming. Suddenly they went from these 160 or 300-acre operations up to the thousands of acres. And so it kind of, I'm going to use a term that's maybe not quite accurate, but I'd say it commodified agriculture. It turned it more into a business and a system of production and a way of life and a relationship.
I think that's fairly accurate.
And also I think that one of the things that film deals with a lot is it changes rural agriculture and that each person becomes more isolated. And I want to talk more with about that in just a moment with John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John, which you can see on June 13th on PBS coming up. We'll put all the information on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment more with John Peterson about this great documentary. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standard set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is John Peterson. You can see a documentary on his life called The Real Dirt on Farmer John this coming June 13th on PBS. You can also buy it. You can link to our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's an amazing, fun, wonderful documentary that talks about all the stuff that we talk about, community farming, organic farming, and the plight of the American farmer in general, and it's also a lot of fun to read. Now, John, you've also written a companion book to the show, the Farmer John Cookbook, right?
Right.
What's that all about? Is that just a cookbook?
Well, I'm so excited about farms, and I felt that a cookbook that I write would have to include the story of the farm itself, so it takes the reader or the cook right out to the farm and gives an experience of how the vegetables were raised, not in a technical way, more in a dramatic or poetic way. The weather dramas, the cook on the farm writing in a very colorful way about harvesting the vegetables. The photographs in the cookbook are of the vegetables growing in the fields or of the people working with the vegetables, because I feel that so often the food arrives in the kitchen, and then it's, well, what do we do with it? Well, where's the relationship with the food? Where's the relationship with the history of it? And so I really wanted to bring that in. And also, I think Rudolf Steiner is an extraordinary, or was an extraordinary man who offered a lot to civilization, and he's not very widely recognized or read, and so I brought some Rudolf Steiner and some of his insights into food, where he often regarded food or expressed food as a material of forces, that it has to do with forces at least as much as it has to do with substance. For instance, he said that leafy things stimulated the rhythmic system, the circulation and the breathing.
You're talking about the biodynamics of agriculture.
Biodynamics. And a very interesting thing that he said, which is really the basis for his lectures on agriculture, which became biodynamic farming, he said, food no longer carries the forces that allows people to transform their will into action or their will into results, that the earth's forces are dwindling and that they need to be re-stimulated, reactivated, because people live in their dream states, they live in their desires, but they're not able to transform them into actions.
We're gonna have to take a quick break there for the news, John. We'll be back in just a moment talking with John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is John Peterson. He is a lifelong farmer and the largest community-supported farm, owner of the largest community-supported farm, or CSA, in the country with Angelic Organics. More than 1,000 families get their vegetables delivered weekly from John's farm. He's also an artist and a writer. The Real Dirt on Farmer John is a documentary spanning decades of his farm struggles. You can see it on PBS on June 13th and find out about it on our website. He's got the Farmer John Cookbook as well. And John, you know, I really would love for you to share with people one of the documentary is great in that it talks about a traditional farming family, how you took over your family's farm at a very young age due to some family tragedy, and how you weathered the storm of the 80s and how you brought the farm back and what exactly a community-supported farm is all about. Can you talk to us about how you've reinvented it that way?
I went down very hard in the early 80s.
Like a lot of farmers.
Like a lot of farmers. And I went from being a very exuberant, enthusiastic, hardworking person to being almost bedridden with grief. And I was sick, or at least I felt sick. And how did I recover from that? It was a very, very long journey. Here I'd lost most of the family operation. My machinery was gone, and
you had to sell off a lot of the family land.
Yeah, I was humiliated and ashamed and so I gradually restored myself. I mean, how I did that, I encountered classical homeopathy, which I think actually was my bridge later to biodynamics, and that works on a deep emotional, deep constitutional level. The classical homeopathy does, and so that gradually helped to restore me, as did actually going through and sorting out all the stuff that had accumulated on the farm. I started to organize my exterior world. It took a couple years of painstaking work. There's a lot of junk, a lot of clutter around, and I as I began to work with my surroundings in that way, I think it started to reorganize myself internally.
And so tell us about how you changed the farm and how you changed the business model of the farm.
Right. Well, I want to say I was on a creative journey, too, and I was doing a lot of, I was writing screenplays, I was performing, I was studying to write the story of my life. So a lot of these things converged to empower me finally to have the strength to just think, oh, I can move forward. So and you asked the question, I just want to pick that thread up. You said, well, how is the United States different from Mexico, or the real culture different? Well, when I started going to Mexico, which I started doing regularly after I lost the land, people there seem much closer to the land. And the culture, the society there seem more sort of, I'm going to use the word rustic, but I think it's more like landed, more grounded. So the way people talk and walk and move, and then just looking out into the fields, often you will see people walking or standing in the fields. The landscape of Mexico is actually populated by human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Drive through the heartland of the United States, and you will hardly ever see a human being out in the fields.
Yeah.
So it rekindled that feeling of relationship to the land, to be in this great country where people were actually living close mm-hmm. to the land. And that was something that I could remember from the 50s, where it seemed that my own countryside was more populated by, much more populated by human beings.
By people.
There was livestock and more life, more vibrancy on the farms. Mm. Now there are shells mostly in the Midwest, mm. but in Mexico you still get a feeling of life just wandering around and inhabiting the countryside.
I want to talk about community-supported agriculture. I really want to get into the CSAs and how that has changed your farm and kind of brought it up to date. And the first question I want to ask you about community-supported agriculture is, do you think it can pierce the mainstream the way the hippie culture pierced the mainstream in the 60s? Do you think that can happen now, 40 years later, with CSAs?
Well, great question. I talk about this quite a bit because what I'm noticing now, well, 20 years ago, there was no community-supported agriculture farm in the United States, and now there are probably a million people that get their food from a community-supported agriculture program.
Just briefly to explain what a community-supported agriculture farm is, that's where people get together and they buy a share of the farm up in the beginning of the season, and you subscribe to the farm, and you get the produce of that farm throughout the season. And so you absorb some of the economic risk of the farmer, and you put yourself in the hands of nature as to what's seasonal and what's harvested when. And you have, coming from John's farm, you have over 1,000 people who every week get a box of vegetables from the farm, not knowing exactly what's going to be in that box. And that's what we're talking about with community-supported
farms. And just so people know, Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi belong to a local CSA in order to get some of our products.
So we interrupted you, John. Go ahead.
Well, you know, from our farm, there are probably about 5,000 people that are eating every week, which I think is just it's a form of a sacrament, really. I mean, in a way, it's a table. The farm is a table, and 5,000 people are eating from that farm's table every week. And when you think about a million people in the United States that are doing this, and when they do it, many of them are thinking about that farm that they're a member of. It's not necessarily an ongoing intentional relationship or pondering, but it has to come into people's consciousness frequently when they're eating the food, when they get the box.
I think it especially comes into their consciousness when they encounter something new, and in the movie you bring kohlrabi out, and when they encounter some product that they may not have encountered in the past.
Yeah, or a shortfall. Mm-hmm. If it's a shortfall, then they go, oh, wow, weather affects the
Yeah, yeah.
I'm now connected to the weather. It's so extraordinary when you think that all these people now are thinking about a place that they call their farm. There's a million people now that have something that they call their farm, and they go out, they take their children out, their children see these vegetables growing in the fields, and sometimes the people get involved in helping on the farm, volunteering to work in the fields, and it re-enlivens agriculture, and it re-ennobles the farmer. The farmer is acknowledged and held in a different regard because now it's the farmer is the farmer for this group of people that belong to the farm.
Yeah, you know, and if you want to find out about how to join a CSA locally, there's an organization you can go to, and we'll put it up on our website. You can go to localharvest.org and find out how you can become a member of a CSA. One of the nice things that I like about the film in the end is how the families do bring their children back to the farm and sort of participate. Now, you write newsletters and you encourage that, right?
Oh, yeah, it's a very, very important part of it.
Completes
the picture, and it just transforms the model that we have of the consumer and the producer. It's a different model because people come together, they get to know one another, they get to know one another's needs, and then, for instance, in our case, we needed land to have the right size farm, and our shareholders came together and they bought that land, and then they leased it to the farm, and so now we're able to have half of our land fallow every year, building up the fertility with alfalfa and clover. And that's because these people who are our customers, you know, often the customers and the producer have an adversarial relationship. They're just trying to get, you know, both sides are trying to get the better deal. But in this case, there's cooperation, there's understanding, there's communication, and magical things have come out of that.
You know, and that does twist things on its head. I mean, while it's certainly still a capitalist endeavor, with our farms, I mean, we are, once we get on board and come up with a way to support things early on, we're all in the same boat together. And that's what a CSA is all about. Listen, we'll be back in just a moment talking more with John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John. You can see that on June 13th on PBS. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today is John Peterson. He is the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John. You can find out more about that great documentary by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and you can see it. It's being aired. You can check your local listings for the time, but it's being aired on PBS on June the 13th. Now, John, one of the things I think that people don't realize when they pay extra for organic vegetables, it's more expensive to produce organic vegetables, and to get someone to make the change, I thought one of the great services the documentary did was to talk about that period when you changed over from chemical-based agriculture to organic agriculture and how you got from one point to the next.
And one of the things you just mentioned is you allow the half of your land to lay fallow for the year so you can switch areas one year to the next.
Yep.
Very expensive.
But even more than that, in making the switch, I mean, you say the land can become dependent on chemicals like people become dependent on drugs, and there's a period of withdrawal. You want to talk about that and your experiences with it?
Well, it seems the land when it's going from a chemical-based system to a natural system, and it has to be repopulated by the microorganisms, and maybe it's a little like someone going into a heroin clinic, an addiction clinic, and then getting from a dependent life to a healthy life. The person is just laying there on the bed in a panic and in huge pain, and so you can't see a farm rise like that, but you have a feeling that's what it's doing because it seems like it shuts down, like the system shut down. And we were raising very unhealthy crops that the insects were invading, and it took a long time to figure out how to build things up and how to get the soil healthy, and a lot of other systems have to be in place. It's not just about healthy soil, but that's a cornerstone of it. And yeah, it took several years before we could actually start getting, you know, full boxes on a regular basis.
You know, I thought one of the other really very interesting parts of your story was there was basically a point where when you came back to the farm and you decided to rededicate to yourself to the farm and decided to go organic and create the farm in the way that you had it in your imagination and in your mind. It wasn't exactly a smooth reentry into the community. There were lots of people that seemed to think that you were a drug dealing, child killing Satan worshiper. Are you really a Satan worshiper? That was facetious.
That still persists a bit in the community. Although now that there's this movie out, people just seem to think I'm a much better human being because I'm in a movie. But really, I don't think that makes me a better human being. I think that regaining a farm, getting a farm back on its feet is a worthwhile and a noble endeavor. And I'm very happy that I did that. But it's interesting that in the community, no one's ever came and said, hey, this is amazing. You brought a farm back to life. But there are people who say, oh, that's so great. You're in a documentary film.
That's funny.
Well, I do think that what you've given people a chance to see is behind the scenes, what actually happened over that period of time. I mean, it is amazing the amount of footage you have from your early life and from the early days on the farm. I just don't think most people have that much footage of their early life in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, no, and my mom loved the bounty of the farm. She loved farming, and so you can really see that in her camera work. Mm-hmm. She just, when we had a good oat crop or a great corn crop or a new piece of equipment, she'd go out there and document it.
What now?
She loved it and wanted to, you know, show it to the neighbors later.
Right, now, you know, your neighbors had some trouble with you when you came back and restarted the farm and turned things around. But you're obviously successful. Forget the documentary. You've turned a farm around and made it economically viable again and a vibrant business. Are your neighbors following suit? Are your neighbors asking for advice? What's going on in the other farms around you? Are other people turning farms around other ways?
Most of the farms are really huge corn and bean operations or big livestock operations in the area, and very few of those people are interested in raising vegetables at all, even if they're struggling with their own operations. A vegetable operation is so dramatically different than the kind of farming that they do. But when you go out further and you find pockets of farmers that are interested, and there's the CSA Learning Center at the farm, a nonprofit organization, has a program in the winter where they help train farmers into transitioning to organic, or they help farmers help people get started farming.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interest, but right in my local community, It's just corn and beans, and it happens on a massive scale. Which I want to point out before the show ends. I don't know if you know this, but the film won the Slow Food on Film Golden Snail Award for
right.
Best Documentary, and we're going to be presenting it in Italy in late October to about 5,000 chefs and farmers. And it's very exciting that the film is recognized by the Slow Food Organization as a kind of a model for agriculture.
Well, the film has won a lot of awards, and Slow Food is just one of them.
25 awards.
It's amazing, and it's amazing to me that everybody in your community isn't like just hasn't seen the film and seen the point behind it in what you've done with the farm. Hey, we have to take a short break, John. We'll come right back. Our guest is John Peterson. He's the subject of the documentary The Real Dirt on Farmer John. You can see it on PBS. You can find out more about it by checking our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is John Peterson. His the documentary of which he is the subject is The Real Dirt on Farmer John. His cookbook is The Farmer John Cookbook. You can find out more about those by going to our website at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, John, the success nationally and internationally about this film, at least in cult film circles, It's got to be really surprising and shocking. But are you getting more recognition farther away from your home than you get at home?
Yes.
I think that's bizarre. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. The movie's great. What you've done with it is great, and the message that's coming out is terrific.
And again, this movie will be on PBS June 13th, Tuesday. In our area here, it'll be on at 10 p.m. A really interesting and riveting program, which I think, especially when you're watching this movie, the first 20 minutes or so of the movie looks like the movie's kind of going in one way, and then your life kind of changes, and the movie kind of turns with it. I found it very interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to say I'm probably going to be in Europe for several months in the fall and winter because the film's got quite a run going on overseas, probably in theaters and and festivals, so it's really getting out all over the world. So it's very exciting, but then again, being on a tour is not farming, and farming is its own form of excitement.
I was just about to say, you're not going to quit farming on us, are you?
Well, I definitely want to have more time to perform and to write. That's very important to me, and I think my mission was more to get the farm back on its feet than it was for me to be personally farming, because as you probably tell from the film, I've got a lot of other creative interests, so the farm on its feet now, it gives me a whole new opportunity for my own life.
Well, I think that's great, and the work you do is really tremendous. You have our the respect is, it's amazing what you've done.
Thank you.
Take care. That was John Peterson. John Peterson is the subject of the documentary, The Real Dirt on Farmer John. It's a great film. I mean, even if you don't care about farming, it's a great film. It's a tremendous documentary, and it's about John.
It was really interesting.
It's about John, but it has a lot of lessons for you know, where our food comes from today and a lot of what we talk about. So hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.